The gray man decided in seconds that he had just been surrounded. "Sergeant!" he called quickly to the cop in charge. The older man was speaking with his subordinates, but he walked over towards Cord on the bench. "Please listen carefully. We have a problem. On both sides of us are green trucks. In or near those vehicles are men who have been sent to kill me. They will not hesitate to kill you and your men to get to me." The policeman looked to his left and right at both of the vehicles, then back to Gentry.
"What is this shit you are saying?"
"They will be well-trained killers. You need to move us all inside the station. Hurry!" Slowly, the policeman pulled his walkie-talkie from his belt and brought it to his mouth. His eyes did not leave Gentry's. In German, he instructed his men behind him to come over. He switched to English.
"Two green vehicles, one to the north, one to the south. This man tells me they are men here to rescue him."
"Not rescue, kill!" All five looked up and down the platform at the vans. There was still no movement from either.
"It's a trick,"
said a young blonde officer as he unfastened the retention restraint over the tang of his pistol.
"Who are you?"
asked another man. Cort didn't answer. Instead, he said,
"We need to go inside, quickly."
The lead policeman told his officers,
"Watch him. I'll check this out."
He turned and began walking up the platform towards the van to the south at the gas station.
"Sergeant, you really do not want to do that,"
Cort called out, but was ignored by the silver-headed policeman in the heavy coat. The cop descended the platform steps and onto the property of the little gas station. The green van had tinted windows. It sat at idle, steam pouring from its exhaust and drifting away in the air behind. As the municipal officer approached the truck, Gentry spoke to the four remaining men.
"He's going to die. Don't freak out. We will all have to work together. If you try to run, they will just gun you down. If you want to live, just do what I say."
"Shut up,"
said one, and all four were looking at their sergeant as he approached the driver's side window. He used his walkie-talkie to tap on the tinted glass.
"Don't forget about the other van," Cort pleaded to the uniformed men standing over him.
"Shut up,"
repeated the policeman. Gentry could see their growing concern as their heads swiveled back and forth between the north and south. The sergeant tapped harder on the glass. As Gentry and the others watched, the silver-haired man seemed to peer closely through the heavy tint. He must have seen something, some movement or other indicator of danger, because quickly the Swiss policeman stepped back and reached down to the pistol on his hip. The driver's side window shattered with a crack of gunfire. The cop backpedaled away quickly and the door opened. A man in a black jumpsuit and a ski mask slid out from behind the wheel and onto the pavement, a short-barreled machine pistol in his hand. He fired another three-round burst into the sergeant's stumbling body, and the Swiss officer dropped dead on his back. All four Swiss cops around Cort drew their pistols, with technique hampered by panic. At 30 yards, an accurate shot would be difficult, but the young men fired rounds downrange as they shouted in shock and dropped for cover.
"The other truck! The other fucking truck!"
Cort screamed as he himself dropped to the cement. He lay on the cold pavement next to the bench, his left arm above him in the seat, shackled to the armrest. The cops looked behind them and saw four masked men walking down the blacktop road towards their position. They all held rifles similar to the man at the gas station, who was now joined by three Confederates. All eight moved closer with confidence, like they had all the time in the world.
"Uncuff me! We've got to get inside!"
Cort yelled, but the policeman just pressed lower into the cement platform, squatted and ducked behind a wooden pushcart or lay flat in the open, and they fired inaccurate rounds at the gunmen as the men in black approached menacingly through the swirling snowfall from opposite directions. A bald-headed young policeman shouted into the radio affixed to the epaulets of his jacket. He crouched 15 feet from Gentry behind a luggage cart that provided him poor shielding from the men on the hill to the north and no cover whatsoever from the men fanned out at the gas station to his south. Cort watched bursts of concrete stitch up the platform, race towards the young cop as he looked the other way and screamed into his microphone unaware. Each explosion of cement and dust tracked closer to him until finally, supersonic machine pistol rounds burrowed into his legs and back. He spun onto his side and twitched on the concrete. The death throes ceased as quickly as they began.
"Somebody give me a gun!"
Gentry shouted. The three remaining policemen ignored him. They fired inaccurately and reloaded slowly with jittering hands. Court swiveled around on the cold concrete. He put his boots against the iron legs of the bench and kicked as hard as he could. He desperately tried to break the large iron end piece to which he was manacled, free from the rest of the 12-foot wooden bench. The metal handcuff bit into his left wrist as he kicked and pulled. Soon, he created a rhythm to his work. A kick with his feet, cracks of the old wood, and searing pain in his wrist and hand. A salvo of automatic fire hit the window above him, sending broken glass over the bench and onto the ground all around. As he kicked, he looked back over to his right. A second policeman had been hit in the shoulder and hip. He dropped his gun and writhed on the cement in agony. It took over 30 simultaneous strikes with both feet to break the iron endpiece away from the wooden bench. On the last drive down with his boot heels, he yanked back with his arm. The pain in his left wrist was excruciating, but the bench broke apart. Gentry crawled to his knees, knelt over the heavy piece of ornamental metal, and lifted it. It was easily 30 pounds and still attached to his scraped and swelling wrist. He hooked his handcuffed arm over the metalwork and hefted it off the platform. Then, in the line of fire from both directions, he ran towards the injured cop writhing in agony in the middle of the platform. When he was still a dozen feet away, he flung the iron out in front of him, down next to the man, and fell with it in a slide. The piece clanged on the cement with nearly as much noise as the gunshots barking all around. His swelling wrist tightened inside the metal cuff. Kneeling over the Swiss officer, he reached to the man's midsection. The cop cried out to his rescuer,
"My hip! I'm hit bad in the... Sorry,"
Court said as he pulled the handcuff key off the chain on the cop's utility belt. It was smeared with the young man's blood. Crouching lower in response to a supersonic whine just inches from his right ear, the American assassin pushed the ornamental iron armrest out in front of him, towards the platform's edge. He crawled along as he pushed it again. The injured policeman reached up and grabbed Court's leg as the American moved away, a pitiable attempt to both seek help from a rescuer and to regain control of his prisoner, as if that were somehow still an issue. Gentry kicked off the dying man's hand, picked the cop's Beretta off the platform, and kept crawling. A spray of subgun rounds chased Court all the way to the edge of the platform, just missing him as he and his iron anchor rolled off. Gentry dropped 4 feet down to the ground and behind the cover of the platform's edge. His adrenaline-tinged brain nearly panicked when he lost the key for a moment in the snow, but he quickly dug it out. Rising to his knees, he kept his frozen red fingers steady as he unhooked the handcuff on his left wrist. Of the 5 policemen who pulled him off the train, only 2 were still in the fight. Both crouched behind poor cover on the platform. Not wanting to place his head in the gun sights of anyone who'd watched him drop off the platform, Court moved down a few feet before he peered back over the top. He shouted to the cops, told them to break cover and come to him. One yelled back that he was out of ammunition. The other had a wounded right hand and was firing over a stone planter with his left. From the look of his technique, Gentry determined the man to be right-hand dominant. Movement in the train station caught Gentry's eye. The few civilians at the station had long since hit the road or hit the deck, so when he saw 2 men running towards the platform inside the building, Court knew some of the attackers had managed to flank his position. The door to the platform flew open, and 2 black-masked men appeared over the policeman with the injured hand. Court raised the Beretta in his right hand. His left was useless with its new injury. At 12 yards distance, Gentry shot both masked men in the face. Their forward momentum, coupled with the bullet's impact, caused them to stumble into each other and fall out the door together to the cold platform. Court's borrowed Beretta 92 locked up with the second shot, empty.
"Hey, slide me that rifle!"
This was the 3rd time he'd called for a weapon. The difference this time, of course, was that the first 2 times were before the 2 surviving policemen had seen him at work. The young cop with the bloody hand quickly skidded one of the gunman's small black rifles across the platform to Gentry. Court grabbed it and ducked back down. It was an HK MP5, the most ubiquitous submachine gun in the world. It felt comfortable in the gray man's hands. The American pulled the mag and found it full, with 30 rounds of 9mm ball ammo. He shouted to the injured cop to slide the other rifle to the uninjured man. When the transfer was made, Court said,
"Put it on semi-auto! Fire one round at a time in each direction! Do that until it's empty! Do you understand?"
"Oui!"
shouted the cop.
"Go!"
In a crouch, Court hurried along the platform's edge, moving north, closing the distance between himself and the four who'd come from the truck on the hill. A train was approaching in the distance from the north. Court heard sirens from the direction of the village. He tried to push everything from his mind as he crawled forward alongside the track through the snow. Everything but the men he knew would now be closing on the platform, just around the corner of the cement ahead. His wrist throbbed, and his knees stung from the window glass lacerations he received escaping from Laszlo Szabó in Budapest the afternoon before. The ever-present pain in his thigh from Thursday's gunshot wound was the least of his maladies at the moment. 10 feet from the corner of the cement platform, he heard them. Men speaking Spanish. Spanish? Was the entire fucking planet trying to kill him? They were tucked down by the steps up to the platform. Though Gentry's ears rang, he was able to make out the clicking and spring-tightening sounds made by the magazine change of an MP5. When he stood, he encountered two masked men, also just standing up. Court fired the HK one-handed, fully automatic, at a distance of less than 10 feet. Both attackers dropped, and Court fired another short burst into each twitching body. He dropped the submachine gun from his hands and hefted a new one off a dead gunman, then spun around and ran back up onto the platform. He never even considered making a run for it, though he had the perfect opportunity to escape both the Spanish-speaking kill squad and the Swiss police. But there was a fight going on. Court was already in it, and disengaging at this point did not seem right. A couple of innocent cops were still alive, and they would not last long on their own. As the sirens approached, flashing lights beat off the few remaining panes of glass in the train station. Court Gentry ran back to the aid of the two policemen, his one good arm holding the HK out in front of him, searching for fresh targets. Chapter 21. Claire Fitzroy sat on her bed and looked out the window at the lawn and the thick forest beyond. The sky had been drab and gray since they'd arrived at the chateau the previous afternoon, but during the morning, the low cloud cover had scattered, and now she could see a great distance. Her lunch was beside her, all but untouched. Her sister was downstairs in the kitchen with Mummy and Daddy, and the men in the leather coats who followed around wherever her father went. But Claire had been excused from the table. She told her parents about her tummy ache, asked permission to go back to her room. The tummy ache was real. It came from the worry that had sat heavily inside her for over a day now. The hurried shuffle out of school, the worried faces of Mummy and Daddy, the argument on the phone between her father and grandfather, the arrival of the men with guns, and the trip in the big black cars to the chateau in the countryside. Something outside caught her attention. She leaned closer to the bedroom window, squinted. Then she stood excitedly. In the distance, she could see the steeples. She knew those steeples. The steeples were from the huge Notre Dame Cathedral in Bayeux, and she knew Bayeux had a police station. It was near the big water wheel her daddy had taken her and her sister to. She remembered the policemen in their smart uniforms smiling at her the previous summer. If she could just get out of the house, maybe she could run across the huge back lawn, through the apple orchard, make her way through the woods and to Bayeux in the cold distance. Once there, she could find the police station and tell them what was happening. They could come help, make the men with the leather coats and the ugly foreign language let her family go. Mummy and Daddy would be so happy. It was a long way away, but she knew she could make it. She was the fastest winger on her football team. She could slip down to the cellar and out the little open window she and her sister chased the cat through the previous evening. Resolute, 8-year-old Claire Fitzroy buttoned up her coat, pulled on her mittens, and cracked open the door to the bedroom. As soon as she stepped into the long and dimly lit hallway, she heard voices at the stairwell, but they came from upstairs. She scurried down the corridor and onto the staircase. Lowering her weight on each step, her little feet moved delicately to avoid making noise. she heard a sudden cry above her. She stopped dead in her tracks and looked up. There was another shout. It came from the third floor. She started to descend again, but looked back up to the source of the noise and heard a low, guttural sound. It was Grandpa Donald. He sounded as if he were sobbing. Quickly now, she made her way to the first floor, bypassing the kitchen and the dining hall carefully, because her parents and sister were having lunch just now. If they saw her, her father would be angry, and he would just tell her to return to her room. The hall turned ahead to the right on the way to the stone steps that led down to the wine cellar. Claire moved quickly, but took care to avoid any noise that would give her away. She turned the corner at a run and nearly crashed into the rear of a huge guard. Claire stopped cold. The man wore a brown turtleneck, and from behind, she could see the black strap of the rifle that hung in front of him on his chest. A handgun and a radio were attached to his belt. He patrolled down the hall, away from her, perfectly silent in his movements. Little Claire did not dare back up or turn and run away. She just stood there, silently, in the middle of the hallway behind him. He walked slowly, 5 feet away at first, then 10, then 20. The guard opened a door to his left. Claire knew from her explorations with her sister the evening before that it was a small bathroom. He pulled the door shut behind him. Behind her, she heard more men talking to one another. Quickly, she hurried past the bathroom door and to the stone steps of the cellar. 1 minute later, she climbed up onto the shelf, pushed her little body through the window, and squeezed out onto the back lawn. She rose to a crouch, looked to her left and right, and saw a man walking a big dog on a leash in the distance. Just like the man in the hallway, he was moving in the opposite direction. Claire looked out past the white stone fountain, past the apple trees to the horizon line. There they were, the steeples of Bayou Cathedral. One more look around satisfied her, and then she was off. She rose and sprinted as fast as her little legs would take her. It was cold, and her breath steamed as she tore past the fountain, reached the other side, and then ran as she had never run in her life. Just weeks ago, she scored a goal in a match against Walnut Tree Walk Primary School. She was on the left flank when the ball popped free from a bad clearance. She scooped it back towards the goal mouth at a dead run, dribbled close, and fired low, her first goal of the season. Daddy had been so happy he'd taken the girls out for pizza on the way home. He'd spoken of it every day since. Claire ran across the green grass of the manicured lawn like she was running for the ball in front of the goal. She just had to ignore the burning cold air in her chest and the little daggers of pain in her legs. She just had to make it into the orchard where the bad men would not catch her. She just had to get to the steeple so she could find the police station. She just had to tell someone what was going on at the chateau. She just had to rescue her family. She was only a few yards from the start of the orchard, could already smell the sweet apples, when the ear-splitting crack of a rifle snapped across the huge lawn from behind her, echoed off the tree line in front of her, and she stumbled and fell head over heels into the low shrubbery at the orchard's edge.
"What the fuck was that?"
shouted Lloyd in surprise. But he knew a rifle shot when he heard one. He poked his head out of the command center. The guard at the end of the hall on the third floor was clearly as clueless as the questioner. Lloyd rushed past him down the stairs. The young American's suit coat was off, his tie was untied and draped around his neck, and his collar hung wide open. His sleeves had been rolled up, and his armpits, face, and hair were covered in sweat. A mixture of perspiration and blood had streaked across his shirt where he'd recently brushed across a fresh wound. At the second floor landing, he nearly crashed into a Belarusian coming up to get him.
"What's happening? Who's shooting?" Lloyd asked. "Come, please do hurry."
Lloyd followed the man down to the first floor. There was screaming in the living area. It was Elise Fitzroy's voice, coming from the kitchen. Men from Minsk yelled back at her. Mr. Felix appeared, asked Lloyd what had happened, and was curtly instructed to return to the library and shut the door. Lloyd started to enter the kitchen, but the guard who'd been leading the way turned back and took him by the arm. He said something, but his English was poor. Lloyd brushed the man's hand off him, but followed him out the back door. At first, the American lawyer saw nothing but the white stone fountain, the green lawn, the distant apple orchard, and the clear blue sky. He followed the guard, moved sideways around the fountain, and found three Belarusians and a dog standing over a form on the grass.
Gentry?
Lloyd could not believe it. How had he made it so quickly to? The man with the dog stepped aside, giving Lloyd a clean view of the body face down on the lawn. Lloyd's jaw tensed.
Shit! Shit! This is the last thing I needed today!
Just then, another security man appeared from the orchard, another 150 yards away. He held the leash of a large black hunting dog in his right hand. Across his chest was a shotgun, and the firm grip of his left hand was cinched around the wrist of a little girl with brown hair. One of the twins. Lloyd hadn't taken the time to learn their names, much less tell them apart. Lloyd yanked the radio off the hip of the Belarusian who had led him out to the yard. He pressed the transmit button.
You,